Hello everyone, and thank you for joining today's webinar, Azure Document DB PlanetScale NoSQL. Our presenter for today is Andrew Liu, who is a program manager at Microsoft. Before we begin, I'd like to cover a few housekeeping items. Today's presentation will run for about an hour. The webinar is being recorded and will be available on demand within 48 hours. A copy of today's presentation and the recording link will be sent to you via email once the files are available. If you have any questions during the webcast, please enter your question in the Q&A widget on the left of your screen and click Submit. We'll try and get through as many questions as we can during the live broadcast. With that, I'd like to turn the presentation over to Andrew.
Hey, as Rohi mentioned, my name is Andrew, and I work as a program manager on the Document DB team. To start us off, I'd like to get a temperature gauge on how many people have used a NoSQL database before. If you could just please vote on the webinar. Awesome, cool. So it looks like a little bit more than half of you guys have used a NoSQL database before. I'd also like to get an idea of how many people have used Azure Document DB before. Okay, cool. Looks like most people haven't used Document DB before, which is great. I will definitely give everyone a nice walkthrough of this. But before I give you a walkthrough, since I have everyone's attention, I'd like to start off with a rant. And by this, I'm going to tell you a little bit about the things I love, the things I hate, you know, things that make me sad. And you know, part of the reason why I love working on Document DB and why I joined this team in the first place. So to start us off, I'm going to tell you about something that makes me really sad, and that is managing servers. Before I joined the Document DB team, I worked on a major e-commerce website. And on this retailer, what happened is I managed a lot of infrastructure, and what really, really made me sad was, you know, I spent a lot of time just doing deployments and just managing, you know, OS updates, framework updates, platform updates. Like every now and then, I would just get an email saying, like, look, we have a critical security update. You have to go and deploy this right now. And, you know, babysitting servers just really wasn't my thing. I really wanted to focus on building my application. I'm not all about just maintaining servers, and so managing all of this, you know, just really made me sad. And, you know, another thing I found was structuring data is surprisingly hard. When you begin a project, you're given perhaps, you know, a spec, a list of requirements, and you come up with a design, and you're thinking, you know, how do I make this design, you know, flexible and extensible in the future so that, you know, When I get additional requirements, when things evolve over time, that my system is able to handle this in a very robust way and be able to iterate quickly. The thing is that, you know, a lot of times, you know, after a year has gone by, another year has gone by, what you've realized is that a lot of requirements that you did not see ahead of time end up adding a lot of bloat to your software, and you really build up this technical debt. And solving this problem is really, really difficult because you're dealing with a high degree of uncertainty for the future. And what's even worse is when you get this wrong. Because when you get this wrong, especially in a heavy data application, what ends up happening is you're going to now spend a lot of time writing migration scripts to manage the schema and indexes of your database. And this is really, really painful, especially when you have a large scale database deployment, when you have sharded your database across many, many instances, and each of them are very strict on, you know, you have to define a schema up front, and as well as the indexes on what you query off of. Well, what ends up happening is you also have a you struggle to do this deployment dance on making sure that things are up as you do these updates. And so this is what got me really, really excited to work on this project, Azure Document DB. And this is what we're all about. So we build a NoSQL database as a service. And it sounds like about half of you guys have used a NoSQL database before. But to catch the other half up, what NoSQL is about in a nutshell is, I mean, it really is a buzzword. I actually really hate this term. And the reason why I hate this is because NoSQL is very varied. It actually encompasses a very vast category of databases, including key-value stores. Examples of this is, you know, Azure Table Storage, wide column stores like HBase, graph databases like Neo4j, and document-oriented databases like DocumentDB. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to focus on document-oriented databases. And what a document-oriented database is, it's a NoSQL database that is really, really good at storing hierarchical tree-like structures. And examples of this is, you know, JSON, XML. But the thing is that, you know, JSON is ubiquitous now, right? So this is why DocumentDB has also made a huge commitment to JSON as a standard. I mean, when's the last time you called a REST API that returned you anything other than JSON, right? And what's special about these databases is that they are built for scale and performance. And when I talk about documents, what I'm talking about is JSON documents. Do not get me wrong, I do not mean Word documents. This isn't for Word, Excel, PDFs. This isn't SharePoint or OneDrive. I definitely mean JSON documents. And what's the thing is that, okay, so why is this interesting? Well, what DocumentDB is about is once you have this JSON store, what we do is we offer guaranteed low latency, and we do this at very, very high scale. We guarantee that we return, you know, under 10 millisecond, single-digit millisecond reads at for P99. We give you a pattern we've designed up front to handle scale out. So for those of you who aren't familiar with this concept, I mean, you can basically, when you're trying to build an application for scale, you can either scale up or you can scale out. Scaling up is, you know, you're getting the biggest, baddest box you can have. You can add more memory. You can add more CPU. But the thing is that you will hit limits, a very hard limit, once you have the biggest, baddest box out there. Scaling beyond that requires you to, well, you scale out and you partition and you you basically you throw more hardware at the problem by partitioning this out. It's globally replicated. What this means is that this supports really good multi-region support for low latency access around the globe. I'll talk about this more in depth. And it also offers schema-free queries over JSON data, as well as multi-document transactions over that through JavaScript. So Azure has a lot of data products, and I recognize that it is sometimes hard to navigate this, especially like even just from data stores. I mean, we have SQL, we have TableStore, we have DocumentDB. So where does this really fit into the Azure family? And the way I like to think about this is, well, really, there's this quote from that I really love. This is from a famous psychologist, Maslow, back in the 60s. And what he said is, well, if all you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And I think that, you know, for the past few decades, well, what we had was relational databases, and relational databases were that hammer. They are very, very good general purpose databases. But the thing is that as time has gone on, new requirements and problems have arisen. Really, like, people like to talk about these problems in the context of the three Vs. You got volume, velocity, and variety. And I'll talk a little bit about those more in depth. But what happened is, as these problems have risen up, we have built a new, more specialized databases. Databases basically have become more specialized, and we now live in a database renaissance. Rather than treating everything as a nail, today we have problems that, you know, if you have a screw, maybe the best thing to do isn't to hammer that screw in. But, you know, we have tools that really fit this scenario. You know, if you have a screw, maybe use a screwdriver. And if you have a nail, use a hammer, right? You want to pick the right tool for the right job. And this is the way I view the database renaissance that we live in, which is, well, we have all of these great databases that fit different scenarios, and you really should choose the best database for the right job. Do not just choose, you know, your favorite database because, you know, this is the one thing that you've used before and it's all you know. Really, problems have, applications have basically gotten a lot more complex. And I'll focus on the first scenario, which is variety. Let's think about the problem in the context of, let's say, a product catalog. And I'm designing a product catalog for an e-commerce website, and as part of this, I want to sell everything from books to laptops to everything under the sun. Well, how would I begin modeling this data, right? So let's go back to something that we all know, we're all familiar with, and that is the relational database. So let's say I want to be able to query off of the book's the title, the author, the number of pages, and, you know, the language. Well, the very straightforward, naive way of modeling this data is, well, I will create a column for each of these attributes, and then I will add an index on each of these columns that I want to be able to query off of. Very easy, very straightforward. The problem arises that, well, I have a varied product catalog, and here comes this laptop, and I'm thinking, gee, who's the author of this laptop, and how many pages does that have? Well, obviously, that doesn't make sense, because laptops aren't books. And, you know, you don't even have to be a rocket scientist or, you know, a brilliant engineer to figure that out. Like, duh, like, laptops aren't books. So how do we solve this problem, right? Well, let's slowly think this through. And the next straightforward answer is, well, maybe I'll just add some more columns to fit these new attributes that I want to be able to query off of. I want to be able to query off of, you know, the processor, how much memory it has, perhaps how much storage it comes with. But the thing is that, you know, adding more columns to a table, this becomes a very sparsely filled table, especially as the number of product types continues to increase, and this becomes a huge waste of space. So what do we do about this problem? Well, let's think this through, and maybe what I'll do is I'll add more tables, right? But the thing is that what if I have, you know, 100,000 or maybe a million, even a million product types? Well, this solution obviously will become very quickly a maintenance nightmare. And when I now need to, let's say, add a SKU attribute, well, doing this across that many tables is really, really painful. And the thing is that even if I were to create a table for each product type, I may have varying features for that product type. For example, let's use, you know, cell phones, our mobile phones as an example. newer phones have all these new radios. They support NFC. They might have newer Bluetooth radios. And as you add all of these new radios, adding these columns for past phones that do not have these radios, well, that really doesn't make any sense either. It becomes very sparsely filled again. So here's how I think you would actually approach modeling this problem, and what you should do in a relational database if you were to build a product catalog is, well, what I'll do is I'll abstract out where I will have products, and then I will have product attributes. And what I do is I create a table for each. I add a column to abstract out the attribute and value for those product attributes, and I'll put a foreign key, the product ID, to be able to join this back to the original products table. That way, what I can do is I can index the attribute and the value, and I can query off of that very efficiently. The problem is when I start hitting a very big product catalog, what happens is, well, joins aren't the fastest thing in the world. They have been optimized incredibly well over the years, but at the end of the day, I mean, this data isn't located in the same space on disk. You're going to involve disk seeks. If you're on an SSD, this won't be as big of a problem. But the thing is that you also need to think about, as I start sharding my database to handle high storage, high throughput, well, each shard is going to be the boundary for a query or a transaction, and being able to join across these databases also becomes very, very sluggish. And you're going to have to do that client side, and this is not an effective way of building a product catalog at scale. So the way you would do this in a document-oriented database is, well, you can just store this as JSON, and if this JSON record has this specific attribute, let's say I have a laptop that has some memory and storage, great. Just add those fields, and you're set. Basically, what has happened is schema is now dictated at a record level rather than at a table level. And what this allows you to do is have varying attributes across various records. This is really, really awesome, and this is what is beautiful about JSON, is that it's self-describing. You'll notice on the left side is basically the schema, and the right side is these values. Very, very good at handling a variety of data when you use a document-oriented database. It just works. This is really, really beautiful. Now, the second problem I'd like to talk about is, well, volume and velocity. This is the problem of scale. And the problem of scale is best told, well, let's tell this in the form of a story. Let's begin with a story. And what my story is about is it's about indexing JSON and fighting zombies at scale. Because, who doesn't love zombies? A good zombie story. So to give you some context, one of the recent large-scale users of DocumentDB is this company called Next Games. And what they have done is they built this mobile game for iOS and Android called Walking Dead: No Man's Land. So a little bit about Next Games. They are a game development studio based out of Helsinki, Finland. They have about 65 employees. And given that, this isn't a gigantic corporation like Microsoft, they don't want to invest a lot of development effort or manpower behind managing servers. And Azure was really a no-brainer for them. Now, what they do is they develop free-to-play mobile games, as I mentioned, for iOS and Android. And they do this for both their own IP as well as licensed IP. And this for this game in particular, what they did was they partnered up with AMC, who has the show The Walking Dead, this is an awesome show if you haven't seen it. I'm sure most of you actually have seen it. It's the most watched cable television show in the U.S. And it's the first cable drama to beat broadcast shows. Really, really awesome. And so here's the problem they came up with is, given that this is a really, really popular show, they needed to be able to scale with the expectations of millions of users on day one. And here's the thing about games that's, I think, really, really interesting and but also very, very challenging. most applications and services, what happens is you grow a user base over time, right? You're going to do is you're going to keep growth hacking your problem. You're going to slowly drive adoption for your service, and you're going to grow a larger and larger and larger user base. Games don't work like this. Games actually have a shelf life. And what happens is prior to the launch of the game, what you're going to do is you're going to have a huge PR marketing push to drive a lot of attention and drive a lot of excitement for that game. And if your game launches on day one and you screw that launch up, you don't get a second chance. So what they needed to be able to do is really to be able to dynamically scale and handle this large volume of incoming users all from day one. Because what ends up happening is you peak at the very beginning of your game launch, and what ends up happening is your game will slowly it'll grow old. It'll get less exciting. I mean, like, games don't really age gracefully, and after, you know, a couple years, well, it's time to build, you know, the next iteration of that game. In order to build this really awesome experience for these users and to drive engagement, so now that I have a large number of users excited about my game, what I want to be able to do is, well, I want to drive engagement and make sure that they continue to play for as long as possible. And one of the ways you can do this is you can build a social experience around this and introduce some competition, right? So now that I have a leaderboard and I have you competing against your friends and excited to do that, I'm going to play more and more. As my friends beat my score, I am now, I really don't like that they're gloating over me. I want these bragging rights, and I'm going to go ahead and beat their score. So building this social experience and these leaderboards, what they also want to be able to do this is, well, to make this really rich, robust experience, this really should be lag-free. It should be really, really responsive and real-time. And to give you kind of an idea of what this looks like, here's what the game looks like. Here's a screenshot of the leaderboard. What you can do is you can form guilds so that you can have, you know, guilds, clans, this kind of groups of friends. And within that, you can look at leaderboards across your friends, across the region, a global leaderboard, as well as chat amongst, you know, your guildies. So the results for this were astounding. They managed to hit number one in the Apple the iOS store on the very, very first week. They had well over 1 million downloads on this first week. They're performing roughly about 1 billion queries per day at peak. And what was really awesome about this is, well, 99% of these queries were served under 10 milliseconds. They were served on single digit millisecond latency. The graph to your right shows you a graph of their volume over time as well as the latency over time, and I find this really, really impressive. To be able to deliver that scale at those low latency numbers, that is phenomenal. So this is really cool. How would you do this? And you know what? This super easy. Just throw some data in a database, right? Problem solved. Well, it turns out life is not so easy. And so why isn't this an easy problem? Like why is this so hard? Well, the thing is that if you were to use a cache, the thing is about a leaderboard is, well, you're constantly writing to this, and you're not even writing a global leaderboard. What you're doing is you're pushing individual player score updates. And as you build this leaderboard, what's happening is this: if you were to cache the leaderboard, this is constantly getting invalidated. So a cache will not solve your problem. You're just going to be evicting entries over and over as player scores update. They also looked at a couple other data stores. They looked at using SQL. But the problem of SQL is, well, they had to shard. They had such high throughput requirements that given the need to shard, they lose a lot of these benefits. So they now lose the ability to be able to really, you know, query using relationships because, well, now they have to query across shards. But at the same time, they gain a few new problems. They now have to manage a schema and index across each of these shards. And this is a non-trivial effort. This is very time-consuming when you're operating a data store at scale. So they looked at NoSQL. That was the obvious next choice, and they looked at Azure Table Storage. But the problem with Azure Table Storage was, well, they also needed secondary index support. So this kind of rolled it out right away. But some of the other problems that they found in this space was, well, they had this requirement for single digit reads. The latency numbers just weren't good enough, and also the throughput. Table storage has a throughput limit of 20,000 IOPS per second, and they needed to deliver much higher throughput than that. So this is where DocumentDB entered the picture for them. They were, what was really appealing for them is, well, this is another database built for scale out. And this allowed them to scale very effortlessly. And this is a database that's also built and optimized for SSDs, delivering awesome latency numbers. What's also special about this is the automatic indexing story around this and the support for secondary indexes so that they can query across other attributes. And because this is a global audience, that they really needed a database that also operated on at a global scale. So what are the challenges behind a mobile backend, right? Let's talk a little bit about how they built this and what a mobile backend does. So the little devices in our pocket, these mobile phones, are actually incredibly powerful. They have far higher computation ability than, sorry, I just saw, Rahi, I'm a bit behind on the slides. Okay. Well, moving on. So, what are the challenges on building a mobile backend? So, given that we have little computers that have more computation ability than the computers that brought us to the moon that ran the Apollo missions, why do you even need servers? Like, can't you just offload all this computation on the device itself? Well, it turns out, we still need something to orchestrate the multiplayer experience across all of these devices. And this means managing the leaderboard. It means orchestrating push notifications to each of these devices. It means even being an authoritative source for facilitating in-game purchases. So what does this backend look like? Well, this is actually a very, very simplified architecture of what Next Games built. This really doesn't do them justice. But the simplified view of this is, well, here are the core components of a mobile backend, right? So you're gonna build this with core Azure services with a queue store. You're gonna need some storage. You're gonna need some logging analytics. You're gonna need something to orchestrate push notifications. And the services that they use is, well, they use cloud services, a bunch of worker roles to manage this backend hidden behind a traffic manager. Events come in and get put into a queue. When serving this out, especially in media blobs, that gets stored in blob storage backed by a CDN. Push notifications are handled by notification hubs. And all of the analytics and data, well, the data gets dumped into DocumentDB, and a set of worker roles works over that data to analyze it. Some of these services that they built behind this include, or what they're using DocumentDB for, was they're storing data to facilitate in-app purchases. They were managing and serving the game front end for this, and notifying and communicating through them through SignalR. They're managing a leaderboard service, a social and guild service, notification service, amongst other things. But what we're going to really focus on is a handful of these services. We're going to focus on a set of services that handle player data and scores, and the guild and social data. Scaling the player data store, here's an example document of what Next Games data looked like. And what they did was, if you notice in the ID, this is a composite ID. The first prefix is the game ID, followed by a data center ID, followed by the player ID. And what they did was they used this composite ID to be able to scale out their data across many, many partitions. And this also allows them be able to query this back very, very efficiently. Right? You can be able to route these queries based off of these set of attributes. Now, what I want you to notice is in this game, at the sample document is at the very bottom. There's a Facebook ID. There's a Game Center ID. These are the secondary attributes that needed secondary indexes to be able to query off of efficiently. What they wanted to be able to do is basically players can auth using, let's say, Facebook or another third-party provider, let's say Google, to authenticate. And what they do is they store the ID in here, and they need to be able to look at or retrieve this data efficiently. One second, let me see what's in team chat. Rahi, can you fix the slides, or do I need to refresh the page? I've just been told that the slides aren't progressing forward as I've clicked next. Okay, I'm going to refresh. Got it. Okay, so hopefully we're on the right set of slides now. Rahi, can you confirm that? Okay, good. So here's an example of the player data APIs. As you can see, you can retrieve these records by the Facebook ID, by the GameCenter ID, by Google ID, and this is where the secondary indices became a very hard requirement for them. Here's also another sample document for how they facilitated the social experience around guilds. What they did was they modeled this data where they loaded guild members and a roster of them as a nested array, and they also put the top a limited set of last chat messages, so that when you log into the game, you're not just seeing messages that have been delivered since you've logged in, but also you have a little bit of history, so that when you log in, you can immediately see some chat messages. And what's interesting about this is, well, JSON gives you the ability of doing this. You can denormalize your data, and you can store all of this as a single record. It's all co-located, and you can retrieve this all back on a point read. This becomes very, very fast, given that they are also a very read-heavy application. So some of the problems they needed to solve was, well, they came up with this composite partition key, and they needed to be able to partition this across many, many nodes. And the way you would approach this is, well, they came up with a hash partitioning scheme and distributed this across many nodes. Now, this introduces some complexity into this application, primarily being, let's say you start off with, for example, 100 partitions, and you find that you are now coming up on your throughput limits, and so you need to scale this to 110 partitions. Well, by introducing 10% more partitions, what effectively is going on behind the scenes is, I mean, your hash partitioning scheme now needs to they're going to route to the wrong partition. So what you're going to do is you're going to have to facilitate some data movement. This is the management. This is why sharding is difficult, right? Really, sharding has two problems. One is the routing queries to the right partition. The second is managing of that and what happens with data movement when you need to scale up or scale down. Well, the way you would typically handle this if you were to do this on your own is you'd come up with a new partition map, and what you're going to do is you're going to track the state of your migration to for scaling up and down. And during the state where you're facilitating this data movement, you're going to mark the state as in process, and what you're going to do is you're going to route queries to both the old partition map as well as the new partition map. And all writes will go to the new partition map, while some marker roles also move data from the old map to the new map. Once you've rebalanced this data, you've adding 10% more partitions will incur roughly 10% of your data being moved. You will now mark this complete and solely consume the new partition map. Now, the thing is that when you're fighting zombies and you got the demands of a game that really needs this robust launch, you don't have time to deal with this partition management. This is a really, really hard problem. And this is a problem that DocumentDB really, really sought to solve for all of our users. So this is why last April we introduced the concept of partition collections. And what you can do is basically all of the shard management gets taken care of by DocumentDB on the server side. You don't have to do anything. And what this allows you to do is you can scale throughput and storage independently. We basically just give you a little knob for throughput. And based off of your throughput and storage needs, what we'll do is we'll handle all of the data management for you. All you need to do is when you make a request, you on write, you're going to make sure that you populate that partition key, and on read, you're also going to give us a hint on that partition key, and we'll be able to route that, you know, efficiently for you. And at the same time, we're going to be able to facilitate all of the management for this as well. So here's kind of some sample code just to show how easy this is. In our old world, prior to April, what we had were some predefined performance tiers, S1, S2, S3, and what you had to do is you had to handle all of this partitioning yourself. April onwards, we have partition collections, and what you can do is when you create a collection, you can also define a partition key, and this is just a path to what attribute in my JSON data should I look at to partition this data. And in this example, what I do is I add this partition key path on Walker ID, I tell how much throughput I want, and I just create this collection. And what's kind of cool about this is you can always also dynamically scale this up either through the portal or through do this programmatically using an update collection operation, and you can dial this throughput up and down. This is really a lot of the value that moving to the cloud gives you is the ability to dynamically scale up and down. You no longer have to buy servers based off of peak requirements. Now, one of the other features that we introduced last April that also go a long way in making large-scale applications really, really easy to build is, well, we have a global presence, and we're actually we're in preview right now. We'll be GAing this very shortly. Is geo-replication, and the concept behind this is, well, I have data, and I have players who access my game from all around the world, and it makes no sense for my players in Europe to have to query a database in North America, right? Like, you are now bottlenecked by literally the speed of light. It's how fast these electrons can move over the wire, and it turns out that when you're shipping packets around the world, you're going to incur some latency here. So what geo-replication gives you the ability to do is you can set up a set of replicas, which you can then perform today read operations off of, so that when users read data, they can now read off of a data center that's well, local to them, and get very, very low latency reads. Tomorrow, we do aspire to also open this up for multi-region writes down the road. That'll come sometime down the road. Now, what's also really cool about this is when you're replicating data and you're dealing with replication, especially on around the globe, now there's some latency for replicating this data. And what this does is you end up having to deal with data consistency. Do I block reads on my secondary regions until they have the latest writes in a strongly consistent model, or do I serve reads as fast as I can with eventual consistency? Well, what we do is we actually give you the ability to tune the consistency level with very well-defined consistency levels, so you can match this to your scenario. And I'll talk a little bit more on this in a little bit. You can also dynamically configure your write region, and this also gives you the ability to automatically fail over. So this from a disaster recovery standpoint, let's say you have a data center that gets, you know, overwhelmed by zombies. Well, No problem. What happens is DocumentDB will take care of this for you, and it will just automatically fail over to a data center that hasn't been run over by zombies. Or you can set on the application side an order of preferences on what you want to fall back on for read operations. What this code looks like. Let's see. One sec. It looks like my slides got a little bit shifted. What's also really cool is what we do is we expose geo-replication through a single global endpoint. You do not need to be able to manage all of these a set of global endpoints yourself in the application. Instead, given this a global endpoint, you basically can set an order of preferences and be able to fall back on them without having to do a deployment or any kind of like config update. This is really, really cool. And in addition to solving gaming and zombies, what we found also a set of patterns with our other customers. Unfortunately, they haven't signed a PR release, so I can't name them by name yet. But we are seeing a lot of activity in the retail, media, and IoT space. Specifically for retail, we're seeing a lot of scenarios around oil product catalogs as well as for master data management. When you have a lot of data stores and you want to find a way of consolidating all of this and aggregating and getting a single view for this data, having a scale-out schemaless data store, it becomes very, very valuable. And we're working with a very large brick-and-mortar retail store on this scenario. We're also working with another retailer on doing product recommendations. And so what they're doing is they're, as a user browses around the retail website, they emit telemetry on the customer behavior, and they use this to facilitate product recommendations in kind of a live virtual basket. And that's surfaced to the users to generate product recommendations. We also have some large European media providers using DocumentDB for on-demand streaming and content delivery across devices. What was really interesting for them was the ability to do very, very low latency reads. And we also have a large auto manufacturer using DocumentDB for a telematics use case. You can think of this as the connected car, where as you're driving around, we have sensors that measure very different aspects of the engine to look at all of the mechanics behind that, and this is used to generate health reports and deliver to the auto manufacturers' customers kind of like a monthly health report on, how is your car doing, if a service engine light has fired, and whether you need to perform some maintenance on it. This also is really valuable from the auto manufacturers' side as well, and what they're doing is they're using this to collect feedback on and use this to iterate and build a better vehicle, a more robust, reliable vehicle. To kind of summarize this, I mean, the scenarios that I think that DocumentDB is a really good fit for include gaming, IoT, logging, personalization, and retail. Really, the two things that it does really well is it handles heterogeneous, a variety of data really, really well, and it also does this really well at scale and delivering this at, with really, really awesome performance. So situations where some signals that should pop out to you on when this is a good fit is when scale and low latency are hard requirements for you. Other signals are, if you have a sharded deployment of MongoDB and you hate managing this thing, great, we hire a PaaS service. We will manage this for you. Same thing if you're using a large scale Cassandra deployment on IaaS. Maintaining this is very non-trivial. Or if you're using Redis and you want the performance of Redis while you still want persistence, you want something that isn't just solely in memory, and to be able to have a persistent data store that delivers this kind of performance. This is DocumentDB should be a big signal for you. Some more of my favorite things on why I think this really, really stands out as a service. One of my favorite things is the ability to query over schema-free JSON. So not only have we solved being able to store heterogeneous data, but we've also solved the ability of automatically indexing that. So you don't have to manually manage your secondary indexes. Instead, what we do is we've built an opt-out mechanism for indexing rather than an opt-in mechanism for indices, so that when your data model is it's got all these varying attributes, we can iterate and move incredibly fast over that without any index management. You can just query off of these, and these will be served back to you incredibly efficiently. The way we're able to do this is, well, JSON is very beautiful. It's self-describing in terms of schema. And what you can do is you can rip apart that JSON and represent this as a tree and build a reverse index. If you were to rip apart each of these JSON documents and build this tree, what you can do then do is you can basically create a merged view of these trees and have these point back to the full document. This is some really, really cool and novel stuff that we're doing here. We actually just wrote a paper that was published, I think, within the past year and submitted it to VLDB. For those of you who aren't familiar with VLDB, it is a big academic conference for very large databases. Well, it stands for also very large databases. It is closely affiliated with, it's one of the Sigmund groups. And if you want to read the paper, there's a URL on the slide here that you can go and check it out for yourself. Now, I mentioned that we give you the ability to tune these indices if you so choose. You don't have to. Everything is automatically indexed. But if you really want to squeeze and get the most performance out of this thing, one of the things you also might want to look at is tuning your index every now and then. It is an opt-out mechanism. And so what this looks like is we have index policies defined at a collection level. And what you can do is you can include and exclude a set of paths. Basically, the most specific path overrides less specific paths. And you can use this to either exclude a path completely and recursively from being indexed, or you can even define specific index types on whether you want a range, hash, or a spatial index. You can also tune the index precision. And what this allows you to do is this gives you kind of a nice knob on looking at the storage trade-off. That said, the index overhead for DocumentDB is actually surprisingly low. For a typical document, I mean, the index storage overhead will vary based off the size and shape of your documents. You can think of if I have more, the more properties I have, the bigger the tree and the bigger the index. But in general, for a general use case, I find that, you know, it's only around like 20-30% storage overhead, which if you were to index every property in any other database, you're looking at an order of magnitude more overhead. So this is I think actually very impressive. But in terms of, you know, if you really want to squeeze the most out of this is built as a Geeks database. We do want to expose all the levers and knobs for you to tune it. This is how you would go about tuning indices. Something else to touch base on is, well, great, I've stored some data, I've indexed it, how do I query this back, right? I've given you my data, and I also want to be able to read it back. Well, the way you read this back is we've built a SQL query grammar over JSON. We've tried to stick, adhere to the ANSI SQL standard as much as possible. So this becomes very, very easy for you to pick up and learn. And one of the big challenges for NoSQL databases is sometimes they get inventive on the query language and the query grammar. What this does is as you have onboarding new team members, this does introduce a learning curve. We recognize that this is a problem, and by embracing SQL, As the query grammar, this becomes very easy and very easy to understand and learn. I mean, if you've touched any kind of database before, this should be very familiar for you. Some of the things that are slightly different, given that I can now denormalize my data as JSON, we have dot notation. You can see with the select clause on my first query, the books.author, what this does is it looks at, you know, within the record for an author property. You can actually then do an author.name in that where clause to look at nested structures and go deep inside nested structures and be able to query off of that very efficiently. You can also do projections and transformations, and this way you can do if your JSON record needs to look slightly different, let's say for a JSON REST API, what you can do is you can project this in the select clause. I mean, this should be very familiar and straightforward once again if you've ever touched a relational database before. And what's also really cool is we have the ability to do joins are a little bit different because you can now denormalize and have nested arrays, and you can represent hierarchical structures. You can model relationships in that manner. If you have a nested array, what join does is, if I don't know the array index of the element I want to look at, and I want to query across all of those elements, what that join does is it does a cross product of nested array elements, and this way you can query across that array without knowing the index value. We also give you the ability to do UDFs. UDFs are pretty cool. I'll talk about them actually on this next set of slides. One of the other really cool things that I really love about this system is the support for transactional integrated JavaScript. What you can do is you can ship a body of JavaScript to the database. This is your mechanism for stored procedures, user-defined functions, and triggers. And where this makes a lot of sense is, let's say I have a batch or sequence of operations. When I have the sequence of operations, given that you have a lot of network requests between your application and database, I mean, these network requests really add up over time. You have the latency of those network requests. And to squeeze more performance, what you may want to do is, strip a body of logic over to DocumentDB. The reason why we've chosen JavaScript for our choice of scripts is, JSON is JavaScript's object notation. It is the way it is the object notation for JavaScript, and therefore programming in JavaScript gives you a really natural and robust and expressive way of interacting with that JSON data. And what you can do is you can then ship some logic to perform this batch or sequence of operations and be able to call this on within a single network request. What's really special about this is this also becomes the boundary for a transaction. And this is our mechanism for delivering multi-document transactions, which is incredibly rare in the NoSQL space. A lot of NoSQL databases will give you asset semantics over a single record. DocumentDB will give you this over multiple documents scoped to what can run within a stored procedure or trigger. And this is also scoped to a partition. Now, where this becomes useful is, like, let's say I have that game again, and I have these two players, Master Chief and Solid Snake, and they want to be able to, you know, trade their inventory of items. Well, in the absence of multi-document transactions, if there's any kind of hiccup, let's say I have some bug in my code, what may end up happening is, you know, I might end up duplicating items. I might lose some items. Like, you really want to be able to safeguard that, right? You want that durability across records. And so what you can do is you can write some business logic to retrieve both of these documents, perform the swap, and commit them. And what ends up happening is, on the server side, if this script runs successfully to completion, this is the equivalent to a commit. If there's any kind of hiccup, we will roll back all of these records. It's an all or nothing commit. If you even want to be able to control this, and let's say you want to manually roll back, the way you would do this is you would throw an exception. And exceptions are the mechanism for rolling back a transaction. Another feature that I think is really, really cool and really, really novel is, I mean, when you're building a distributed system, one of the things that you encounter right away is Brewer's Cap Theorem. And what this says is, well, when you're building a distributed system, I want a consistent view. I don't want to be able to get stale reads. I want this to be highly available, and I also want this to be incredibly tolerant in the event of a partition failure. Now, what's really cool, what's really hard about this is, if I want to have strong consistency, what I'm doing is, as I replicate that data to a set of replicas, I'm now blocking reads until I can get a consistent view of the world, so I don't serve any stale reads from those replicas. Now what you're doing is you're sacrificing a bit of availability for consistency. And this sometimes will make sense for you, sometimes it will not. Where this will make sense for you is, let's say I'm building a order processing system. And what I'm doing is I'm processing a set of orders, and I'm using this to process payments. You really, really do not want any stale reads from this, right? If you were to process an order for payment, and then you were to get a stale read, and you were to process that order for payment again, you're very quickly going to end up with some very angry customers. But the thing is that, let's say I'm now building some kind of social application that resembles Facebook. I have a news feed where users need to be able to comment on it. I really don't care if my friends don't see my comment right away. In fact, what I really care is I want my system to be as low latency and as available as possible, right? Well, in that case, what I want to do is I want to tune down its consistency, maybe to an eventual consistency model, so that I serve operations as fast as possible. But the thing is that this gives you two extremes. And what I think is really cool about DocumentDB is it also gives you a few quick stops in between the notion of session and bounded session consistency and bounded staleness. And what session does is it allows you to basically read your own writes. When you perform a write operation, what we'll do is we'll pass back a session token. Any follow-up reads using that session token is guaranteed to see at least that write. It will not see any data that is more stale than that. And this makes programming a lot easier, right? So if I were to go back to that comment on a newsfeed example, when I post a comment, as the user who posted it, if I refresh that page and I that comment were to disappear on me, this ends up becoming a very confusing user experience. Did my comment actually go through? And what you end up having to do is you're going to have to build in some mechanisms on the client side to remember that you've posted that comment. Well, what session consistency allows you to do is make that programming model a lot easier. You can be able to read your own writes. And what's cool about this is once you choose a consistency, you choose how many regions you want, and we will handle this really, really hard problem for you. This is all handled for you. I believe I'm running close on time, and I have done a lot of talking. What I'd like to do from here is open this up for questions. On the bottom of your webinar screen, you should see a Q&A button. From here, you can submit questions, and I'll try to answer these in the order that I've received them. So Tonio has asked, I have a current customer who's using MongoDB. What makes DocumentDB? Any advantages I can leverage? The biggest advantage, in my opinion, and this is my opinionated answer, is DocumentDB is a platform as a service. MongoDB is incredibly difficult to manage at scale. Once you are now putting up replica sets, and you also want to replicate this for disaster recovery, managing this is incredibly hard. This is a problem you don't even have to think about when you're using DocumentDB. Management of the service is all taken care of on our end. Tonio has also asked, can DocumentDB handle encrypted data? Right now, what we support is encryption in motion, meaning that all data in motion, any request, we do enforce TLS or SSL We don't allow you to communicate to DocumentDB on an unencrypted channel. So it is secure by default. It's not like MongoDB where they'll let you communicate over an unencrypted channel. In fact, I think Mongo doesn't even support SSL as a default. It's an option you have to turn on. Now, for encryption at rest, this is something that is still on our roadmap and we have not been able to complete just yet. This is something that we do intend to work on, and it's a matter of when, not if. However, I don't have a timeline on that yet. In the meantime, there are a lot of established patterns for doing client-side encryption. And I'd be very happy to work with your customer on finding a solution that works for them. Vishal has asked, can you give more details about the partition thing and how do you handle right across, how to write cross-document queries? Oh, okay. So the way partitioning works is you can think of it as we maintain a partition map behind the scenes, and we use the partition key to distribute your records, your documents upon write. On read, what you're going to do is you're going to supply a hint on which partition key you want to scope your query to. So when you do a query on a partition collection, you basically have two options. You can say, I know that I've, let's say, I have a multi-tenant system and I've partitioned my data across tenant ID, and I also know that I want to issue a query for this particular tenant. In that case, if you tell us what the tenant ID is, we will route that query to the correct partition, and we will only have to touch that partition. Now, if you wanted to now query data across all of your tenants, across all of these partitions, we also give you the ability to issue fan-out queries. Something to keep in mind on this is because you're fanning out this query, this will be a more expensive query for you to run. Santiago has asked, what's the preferred way to perform analytics on DocumentDB data? Do you have something similar to the aggregation framework of MongoDB? We do not have an aggregation framework like MongoDB. In fact, even if you were using MongoDB, MongoDB would the documentation advises you to stay clear of it. And the reason is that the aggregation framework really doesn't scale across multiple nodes and doesn't scale across multiple partitions. And the best patterns for performing analytics is we have a Hadoop connector for DocumentDB. We also have a variety of connectors for Power BI, for Data Factory, as well as a connector for stream analytics if you want to do stream analytics on the write path rather than doing batch processing using Hadoop. So you have a variety of options, and this is a very rich ecosystem. Really what the stream analytics guys and HD Insight with Hadoop have done is incredibly rich from a stream and batch processing point of view. I definitely recommend giving those a look. And for visualization, we do have a Power BI connector. Jane has asked, what is the timeline for GA? The service actually has GA'd already we've been GA about a year and a half. I believe we GA'd around April 8th of 2015. We do have a set of preview features. The set of preview features that we have not yet GA'd are is the protocol support for MongoDB, which is and what's really cool about this feature is it's actually protocol support at a wider level protocol, and what this allows you to do is connect existing MongoDB applications to DocumentDB just by changing the connection string. You don't actually have to rewrite the service or do any development effort or work on your end. And because we understand we've added support at a wire protocol level, this means we have support for all MongoDB drivers, as opposed to implementing this on a SDK level, which would scope this down to whichever set of SDKs are supported, right? So really, really cool. I don't have a timeline for GA for protocol support for MongoDB just yet. The other preview feature we have is geo replication, aka GlobalDB. And this one, our target is, I mean, within the next couple weeks. If you have, you know, a production workload that you really need production support for, and if we're still in preview, I mean, you can also reach out and contact me. I'd be happy to work with you on getting production level support. For reaching out and contacting me, I have my contact info here. Easy ways to reach me, you can email me at andrl@microsoft.com, or you can also tweet me. I am I do monitor Twitter quite a bit. You can tweet me at alouie8. We also monitor our MSDN forums and Stack Overflow tags very closely, so if you want, you can post on there, and we'll definitely get back to you. Looks like we are at time. Yeah. Rahid,
yep,
do you want to?
Thanks for the great presentation. So everyone, please take a moment to leave any feedback that you have. This feedback really helps us to make these webinars more effective and to improve them in the future. And while you do that, as a reminder, we will be sending out the slides of the full presentation and a recording of the session within the next day. I'll leave this up for a moment for people to fill in their feedback, and that concludes our webinar. Thank you, everyone. Have a great day.